Erev Tov, guys. Shkoyach Gadol on coming out, whether over Zoom or in person. We're here for our third annual Haggadah workshop. And thank you so much for joining us. And thank you to our esteemed Rebbeim for joining us. We are joined by Rabbi Yitzi Sprung, Pochsping Bechvod Achsanya. This is his house. This is where he gets drashos every week, spreading Torah and putting people to sleep. And hopefully not tonight. And new and cool in town, Rabbi Yaakov Silverman. We're going to open up with Rabbi Silverman as the newest, coolest Rebbe in town, and it'll be up to Rabbi Sprung to convince you guys that he is, in fact, cooler, even though he's not newer. Rabbi Silverman, please, bechavod.
All right, guys. So the Pesach Seder. The Pesach Seder is full of tradition and Mesorah. So many parts of the Seder are done without us really understanding what we're doing, why we're doing it, and so many different aspects of the Seder are even done just to engage the children and the people who are there following along with the Seder, just to ask questions, just to be involved. You know, they tell a story about there was a particular family who had a great tradition. There was a family that they took their minhagim, they took their customs very seriously. And every year, towards the end of the Seder, when they came to Lashana Habab Yerushalayim, towards the end of the Seder, at the end of late into the night, they would all, you know, stand up and start dancing together. And as they would dance around the table, there was one spot at the table that, for some reason, the family custom was that they would duck their head as they crossed that little corner of the table. And like that was just what they did. And there were so many parts of the Seder. There was like too many questions to ask. That kind of just like slipped by every year. They did the same thing. And finally, one year, one of the kids like, what are we doing? Why do we like duck? Why is that our family thing? So they're like, we don't even know. The parents are like, we don't know. You got to ask the grandparents. So they go to the grandparents. The grandparents like, oh, well, you see, we used to live in another house. And in that house, the way the ceiling was shaped, you kind of had to duck in order to get around the table without bumping your head. And that kind of just became the tradition in our family. So even when we moved, we just duck, and that's just what we do. You know, so many of the things, we just do them because we do them. We don't even know why we're doing them. But two big aspects that the Gemara talks about that are brought down in Halacha that we do on the Seder is, first of all, the style with which we interact at the Seder. We interact in a question-answer form. Instead of just feeding the information, instead of just reading, even though it does seem, you know, when you're an hour and a half into Maggid, you're just reading and reading. Sometimes it is actually, a lot of it's in question-answer format. We're trying to engage in questions so that there could be answers. What's with the question-answer? Why do we care so much about questions and answers? Just get the information out there, first of all. Second of all, another halacha is that maschil bignus u'misayim b'shvach. We start with the negative, and then we move on to the positive. We talk about mitchila ovdei avodah zarah, hayu avoseinu. We talk about how Avram Avinu used to serve idols, how the Jewish people in Mitzrayim weren't in the greatest shape. We weren't doing necessarily the greatest things. And slowly, we became a better people. We became a better nation. But we started with humble beginnings. We didn't necessarily come from the greatest place. It's where we developed into. Why are we highlighting the fact that we were once not the greatest people? Let's just focus on the good. Who cares what happened? Let bygones be bygones. Let's leave that. Let's not talk about that. Let's talk about the fact that we are a Jewish nation. We left Mitzrayim. We left Egypt together as a nation. We're in good hands now. We're in a good place. Why do we have to, like, you know, talk about all the bad times and how we weren't necessarily connected to Hashem and we were struggling as people and we were serving idols? Like, well, why is that even important at all? So those are our two questions. First of all, why are we engaging in this question-answer format? Why don't we just study the information? And also, why are we even highlighting, why are we even mentioning the bad parts? There's a famous magician. He doesn't refer to himself as a magician. He calls himself he says, I do endurance art. That's what he calls himself. His name is David Blaine. I'm sure you guys have heard of him, seen some of his stuff. The guy is absolutely insane. I mean, he goes underground. I don't know if this word even existed before he started doing his stunts. He says he's entombed. To entomb somebody, have you ever heard that word? To be entombed means that you go into a tomb. You go into he went into this casket, basically underground, stayed there for a week. He went into a block of ice for 72 hours. I mean, the guy, he spent 36 hours on top of a pole. He spent 40 days in a box suspended in midair just drinking water, not eating food. I mean, the guy's just done everything. So one of his biggest acts, though, was at the time he broke the Guinness Book of World Records record for holding his breath underwater. He did it with some with the help of some extra kind of oxygen. I don't exactly understand it, but for 17 minutes, a little bit over 17 minutes, he was submerged underwater without breathing. And you know, you could just imagine, when he comes up from that, being underwater, that first breath of fresh air, that first breath of air he takes, has got to be the most appreciated breath of air that he's ever had in his life. After 17 minutes of being submerged underwater, there's nothing more enjoyable than just breathing fresh air. You know, we take breath, we breathe in, we inhale, we exhale multiple times throughout the day. Hundreds and thousands of times throughout the day. We never think about it. But that breath of fresh air, after those 17 minutes underwater, must have been just the most enjoyable, the most refreshing, the most perfect breath of air that he's ever experienced. Sometimes it's through the challenge, it's through the hard time, it's when you don't have it, if it's when you're missing something, that's when you actually come to appreciate what you're now going to experience. It's because he didn't have the ability to breathe for 17 minutes, so that breath of fresh air became that much more enjoyable. And I'm sure most of you are Chicago Cubs fans. I don't really get like the breakup yet, where the White Sox line and the Cubs line is drawn exactly.
Self-respect.
That's how it is. Okay. I'm not going to even ask which side you're on, but yeah. I feel like both sides could say that, yeah. So the Cubs. I mean, look at the Cubs. For 108 years, this is a struggling dynasty. This is a team who's just never able to get it together. And finally, after 108 years, in 2016, as you all know, they finally pull together and win a World Series. Do you think the enjoyment the Cubs fans and the Cubs team felt was the same as the Yankees, who just basically do it every single year? It's just like, it's a given. If they don't win, it's like, why are we not winning the World Series? Something's wrong with us. It was a suffering, struggling, painful experience to be a Cubs fan. You just never experienced any good. It's never been. You never got that elusive World Series. And finally, after 108 years, just the enjoyment, the euphoria you feel when you finally reach your goal, after all that just frustration, is so much different. It hits different. It's not the same as just somebody who wins every single year. It feels something's different about it. It's not the same. And that's what is the goal at the Seder as well. We want to have that struggling period. We want to have that time where the question kind of festers. We want to ask a question when you're coming from a place of not understanding. When you're struggling to understand something and then somebody answers the question from you, it's so much more enjoyable. The information is so much more meaningful. When you didn't just weren't just fed that information. You asked a question. The question means, hey, something doesn't make sense to me. And when something doesn't make sense to you, and then you're elucidated, you're enlightened by the information that is presented, it's so much more meaningful. It's not just the information that's just given to you. It's that you were missing something. You were missing that breath of fresh air. You were missing that World Series. And then when you finally get it, it's just so much more meaningful. So the question, the fact that we're asking questions that show that we don't have that understanding, that makes the information so much more meaningful. That's on one hand. And then similarly, Maskel Ben Yosef, Masayim B'Shvach, we start with the bad stuff, and we go on to the good stuff. The bad stuff, the fact that we were a struggling people, we did idolatry in our humble beginnings. When we recognized who we were at the beginning and how weak we were as a people, as our forefathers were so weak, then it's so much more meaningful when we now realize, look where we've come. We were that dynasty, struggling to finally pull through. And now it's so much more meaningful. The Maharal says that this is the reason in Judaism, the night comes before the day. Right? We know that in the way the calendar works, the day starts at 12 a.m. And you have the day, which is followed by the night. But the Maharal says in Judaism, we start with the night. The night is that time where we can't really see, we can't be effective. That's the time that we sleep. It's only when you go through the night, that's when you wake up in the morning like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. I've been stuck in my bed. I can't do anything. I don't know. Nobody here probably enjoys sleeping. You know, it's not like a thing to do. Why would you sleep if you could be doing stuff productively? You know what I'm saying? That's what most teenagers think, that sleep is just a waste of time. I'm just kidding. Yeah. But the night before the day enables us to realize just how awesome, how much opportunity we have during the day. We have to experience that lack of ability, that lack of time to be productive in order to actually maximize and capitalize and realize just how good that time is that we have. And that's a concept that I think in general we need to work on. I'm just going to end with this. There's a pasuk that is often quoted, Sheva Yipol Tzadik Vekam. The tzadik, the righteous man, He falls 7 times before he actually succeeds. And I think as teenagers, as human beings in life, the tendency is, we think that like when we're struggling, that's not a good time. Let's forget about that time. Let's just focus on the good times. But in reality, we have to remember that as we're struggling, as we're working through things, as things are difficult, as we're not enjoying what we're doing, as we're not enjoying being a productive Jew, as we're waking up late and we feel bad about what we're doing, and then you can't just forget about the times. You have to realize, you got to tap into those times and say, I understand I'm struggling. I understand it's a bad time. But look where I can go from there. Look what I could do when I then wake up on time for Shacharis the next morning. Look how much better it feels. Look how much more meaningful it is. So don't just forget about those bad times. Take advantage of those bad times and say, yeah, I've done something wrong, but I can move forward. I can move up from here. So that's the message of the Seder. That's why we start with the bad. We start maschil b'gnos. We start with the bad and we end up with the good. That's why we ask the questions. And then we go on to get the answer so we can experience that suffering, experience that failure, that lack of understanding, so that the information and the experience will be that much more meaningful. Thank you so much for listening. Chag Kosher v'sameach, everyone.
What a pleasure to meet you. What a pleasure. Oh, I put my phone down there. Are you recording?
Yeah.
Okay, send it to me. Okay, I'll make a deal. If I go too long, so you can tell me. If I'm too short, so okay, it's nothing we can do.
So you'll get the quarters of it down instead of a full.
Exactly. By the way, I was lured here under false pretenses. I thought there were going to be Donnie's like falling from the sky. Great tzaddikim. Let's learn together for a few minutes. I want to talk to you about something which I hope will totally change your experience at one particular moment in the Seder. Okay, listen. If you're like me, so you had a lot of Haggadahs at home, right? A lot of Haggadahs. What does the Russia look like? What? He looks. What's he doing? Tell me about him. Angry, yelling. Ever notice what's he doing in a lot of the Haggadahs? Obviously, it's like Pashut. He's smoking. Right? Do you ever notice this? Go through all the Haggadahs at home. Like 5% of them, if they have pictures. Okay, so the Chacham, he looks different in every single Haggadah. Okay, Tom, Shano de Elisha, okay, it's a little baby. But the Russia, like, he's got a cigarette.
What?
He's got a cigarette. When we look at the Arba Banim, so we think to ourselves, okay, here it is again, same lame idea. Can we please move on to the rest of the parts of the Haggadah that are incomprehensible to me and I don't understand? I want to absolutely change. I hope forever the way you see the Arba Banim. This piece changed it for me. It comes from the Torah Shlema Haggadah by Rabbi Menachem Mendel Kasher. Listen to what he quotes over here. Arba Banim, the 4 sons. Heim Arba Shenichnasu LePardes HaChakira. They are the 4 who entered into Pardes of Chakira, of investigations. Maza, what does that mean? My stories aren't as cool as Rabbi Silverman's. What does that mean, Pardes? Anybody know? What?
The yeshiva.
They went to yeshiva? That yeshiva? No. All right. Close. Listen. In the Gemara, Pardes means they asked the deepest, most secretive questions about Judaism. It's called esoterica. 4 of our greatest chachamim, the Tanaim, entered into the study of the deepest secrets of Judaism. Now you and I, we do the mitzvot, we do our best. We're good, mediocre, excellent, tzaddikim, benonim, we are who we are. But the chachamim, they're not like us. Okay, they've traversed the entirety of halacha. They've seen it all, okay, they know it. It's not just like, oh, they know Tanakh by heart, they know Mishnah by heart. No, they have studied every single thing. And they know the deepest meaning behind every single thing. Arba nichnasu l'pardes hachakira. four people, four of our great sages, studied the deepest secrets of Judaism. Number one, Hachacham, Nichnas b'shalom v'yatza b'shalom. Very good. He was a spiritually healthy person before he started asking his questions, and he was spiritually healthy after he started asking his questions. Two, HaRasha, Kitzetz b'netiyot. The Rasha started off as a great sage, a great tzaddik, great scholar. But when he came out of asking the deepest questions in Judaism, he was no longer a believer. He was a heretic. Hatam, Hitzitz v'met. The Tam, the simple sage, he looked into the deepest secrets, and he died. It killed him. She'eno yudei lishol hitzitz v'nifka. The one who couldn't quite understand even what he was getting into, he didn't die, but he was damaged. These are the four sons. I want to say one thing here. Maybe this piggybacks a little bit on what Rabbi Silverman was saying. Tell me. Who are the four sons? Is it just four kids at the table? Everybody makes a joke. Oh, yeah, him. It's him. It's him. When we think about the Arba Banim, we sit at the table, we're like, oh, he's good. He's bad. This one's okay. We think people are who they are. That's not true. Okay, the Arba Banim are people who have done their very best in life. And when it came down to it, it didn't work out for everyone. They asked the deepest, toughest questions. And you have to know that investigation is fraught with danger. That doesn't mean that we don't seek to ask. The whole Haggadah is to get us to ask questions, right? And it's a growth process. But there aren't any guarantees. Not every single person, not every chacham from the chachamim, the greatest human beings who ever walked the face of the planet at the same time, not everybody made it. So here's the deal. When you read about the Arba Banim, Sotista Kalvas, I think very, very hard. If they ask questions and not everybody made it, so what does that mean for me? Am I really promised like all the simple good stuff that I think I'm going to get without any effort? Is everything really going to work for me if I don't work hard? If I don't learn well? If I don't muster up the patience to be kind to my sister? To not speak back to my mother? Do we really think we're in such a position of strength that we can go out blindly without any effort and just nail this thing? I'm telling you, it's all on the line. Every single thing we do matters. The Haggadah is like a giant practice section. Asking questions, it's integral. It's impossible to live without it. But you have to put in a lot of effort. God willing, every single person in this room is going to nail being a human being for the next 100-odd years. You're going to be the best group of human beings ever this planet has ever seen. But not without knowing the stakes. Not without knowing you could fail massively, that everything could come crumbling down. You have to take the Haggadah very, very seriously. If we ask these questions, they're not like, oh, it's the Pintala questions. These are serious questions. Our lives are very, very serious. It matters who we are. It matters how we live. Your habits right now could make or break you. If you look in the mirror and you think that you're not so successful right now, it's time to make a change, because that'll stick with you if you don't start making changes. Kachazed the Haggadah. Okay, the Haggadah is a giant reminder. Get together with your family. Have delicious food. Prepare vartlach. Remember above all that the way you live right now really, really matters. You need to prepare for a very long and hopefully, God willing, very successful journey for your whole life. So thank you so much, Rabbi Zucker, for the opportunity. Shkach again, Rabbi Silverman. Shkach to you, great tzaddikim.
Yeah, Shkach, Rabbi Sprung. Thank you. All right. If it's okay with you, bechavod, the esteemed Rebbeim who preceded me, I'm going to ask for a little bit of interaction. Okay? What that means, because oftentimes when we ask for it, no one says anything. What I'm going to ask for is at some point, I'm going to ask you to say something, and someone for you is going to have to speak up. Is that clear?
You got your guy right here. We're talking right here.
All right, see, clearly the chaver in the back, you know, the upperclassmen know how to speak up. Gevaldik. Chazal say that you're not supposed to interrupt, and so I'm giving you license to interrupt for the next couple minutes. Okay, thus far you've been very good. This is just a few minutes. Your whole life shouldn't be interrupting, just a few minutes. So I'll tell you a story. There's a family, they're very concerned about their son, and so in order for his safety, for his protection, they send him off. They send him away, not knowing if they'll ever see him again. Sure enough, that son is taken in by someone else, a local, someone who's in a position of power, and raises that son to be successful, to be powerful, to be strong, and that person eventually uses his position, uses his appreciation in the fact that he's not necessarily from this place, he's not necessarily from the milieu, if you will, it's a fancy word for this place and this environment, and he uses that as a strength to end up helping the locals, to end up eventually saving the people. Now tell me, this is the interactive part, who did I just describe?
The hero.
Shkaya. Could we be more specific?
Moshe.
Moshe. Any other thoughts? Let me try one other hint. I like Moshe. He's supposed to be the voice of God. So there are two options here. One of them is Moshe Rabbeinu. Yalkut Shimoni tells us Moshe Rabbeinu was the voice of God. God spoke from Moshe's throat. The alternative option, if you are so superhero inclined, is that of Superman. Superman is basically the exact same story as Moses. It's not surprising. The authors of Superman were, in fact, Jewish guys. They went to yeshiva, they knew their stuff, and they decided to make comic books for a living. Let's try another one, and I'm going to tell a story. It's not necessarily a story about the Haggadah. It's not necessarily a story that you learned about in your Chumash class. So as soon as you recognize a story, I just want you to interrupt and yell out, what story am I describing? Okay? You got a young man who, he's an orphan, he's living with his parents, and one day, someone who he doesn't know, he doesn't recognize, but who seems to know him, approaches him. This guy happens to have a long beard and tells him that he is actually much more powerful than he can possibly imagine. And this young man is going to go on to be extremely powerful in this foreign world that he never knew really existed. Huh? Awesome. I'm going to keep going. See if you see anything else. And what do you know? He meets a friend. He actually meets a guy and a girl. The guy happens to be a little bit scruffy. He's often very funny. The girl... Oh, what do you know? Now, we can keep going and going and going. And eventually, as I continue the story, you'll start naming tons and tons of stories. The two that come out, the two that maybe were most obvious to us, are that of Harry Potter, because we're very well read, and that of Star Wars. Star Wars is a movie. We don't need to read into who quoted the movie and who quoted the book. We don't have to cast judgment or dispersions on those who prefer movies over books. But
he was quoting the movie.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. But if you think about it, we don't have to be Dorish entirely. The Harry Potter story, the Star Wars story, and many, many other stories, but you know, Beowulf, the Odyssey, lots of stories out there, are really stories that are very, very similar. If you track them on a chart, there's a ton of points that overlap. To the effect, really, when you're reading Harry Potter, you're seeing the exact same story that you know about from Star Wars already. So let me ask you the question. Why in the world would I want to watch a Harry Potter movie, or, more appropriately, read a Harry Potter book? It's always more worthwhile to read books than watch movies. We could talk about why another time. But just know, for the purpose of your brain, you're much more better off not watching movies and instead reading books. So why would I ever read Harry Potter if I know the Star Wars story? But how are they different? They have different details. They have different details. Although the arc is tremendously similar. What do you know? Who's the villain in the Harry Potter story? Someone who happened to have killed the protagonist's parents, and they actually have like this deep-seated connection for all time. And the exact same story exists with Star Wars. He might not have actually killed his parents. He might actually be his parents. But it's all very, very similar. The storyline is more or less the same. However, we keep leaning into it. And in every story that we see, and there's a guy who wrote a book now a while ago named Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell wrote a book called The Hero of 1,000 Faces. And that's not an exaggeration. He literally read over 1,000 books, 1,000 stories, both from mythological to modern day, although he died like, I don't know, 50 years ago. But all these stories have the same theme. And so the question that he asks is, why do we keep repeating the same story? Why do we keep repeating the same arc, the story arc, over and over and over again? Something that he calls a monomyth. What does mono mean?
One.
a monomyth implies, and it's the same story, the same myth, the same character arc every single time. So why are we reading and watching the same story every single time? Joseph Campbell suggests because it's not a story about someone named Harry Potter. It's not a story about someone named Beowulf. It's not a story about someone named Luke Skywalker. It's actually a story about us. And the story arcs are really a story about us. And we see ourselves in these stories. Not, oh, I can relate to the character, but this is actually a story about me. Now, maybe I'm not going through the exact literal journey. Maybe I'm not getting a wand. I'm not getting a flying broomstick or a lightsaber. But it's still the same story. It's still the same challenge. It's still the same circumstance. And in this monomyth, maybe I'm not fighting a dragon that has wings and breathes fire and a tail, but I am fighting something. I'm fighting someone else in school who's not so nice to me. I'm fighting a boss in camp or wherever who basically is a fire-breathing dragon, as some of us might have experienced. And so we're all always going through this story, and which is why we connect to it so much. We keep interacting with it because it's really our story. Now, we spent a long time not talking Torah, so we should probably connect to Torah if I want to keep my job. Why do we read the Haggadah? What's the point of this whole Haggadah story? Rabbi Sacks says that Jews don't believe in history. Jews don't believe in stories that happened in the past. So what are we doing at the Seder? We're not talking about history. History, by the virtue of the name, his story, is something separate from me. Instead, Jews don't do history. How do you say history in Hebrew? Historia is okay. So let me ask you a better question. How do you say history in Hebrew? You don't. There's no Lashon HaKodesh word for history. Anytime there's a historia at the end, it means that Israelis couldn't figure out a better word. There's another way to say banana, and I just don't remember. Banana is not the only way to say it, but you're right. History is not a word that exists in Lashon HaKodesh because Jews don't believe in history. Jews don't record history. There are no Jewish accounts of history beyond the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash for like 1,000 years. So Rabbi Sacks says, what do Jews believe in? Not history, but memory. Now what's the big difference between history and memory? History is something that happened to somebody else. It's his story. Whereas memory is something that happened to me. And maybe it didn't happen to me literally, but it happened to me in that it affects my life. If I lose all my memories, if I no longer know who I am, I'll become a different person. Because all the memories that I have actually make up who I am. And so if I lose those memories, then I'm no longer me. But that means that if I have a memory, then that makes up who I am. That makes up where I'm going. The Seder night is a night of memory, a night of Zechira. Now, how does that relate to what we're talking about? How does that relate to Joseph Campbell? Because if memory is supposed to be something that's relevant to me, and Jews never study something like history that's not relevant, then maybe that it means that the whole purpose of the Seder, the whole purpose of Yetzias Mitzrayim, is to see it as a memory, to see it as something that's related to me. Not something that I can learn from, but something that's mamish about me. Just like Harry Potter is really a story about me and the things that Harry Potter goes through, except for some of the inappropriate scenes in the fifth book, in Yetzias Hashem, we won't have to deal with those. But the things that Harry Potter goes through are the same things that I'm going to go through. The struggles he has are the struggles that I have. And so too, the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim is a story that I go through as well. The leaving Mitzrayim is something that I experience as well. And maybe that Yetzias Mitzrayim is not going to exist in the form of a king, but maybe, like a dragon that we talked about before, there'll be some sort of Yetzias Mitzrayim that's going to happen to me in my life. That's the idea of Joseph Campbell. That's the idea of a monomyth. And that's the idea that exists in Yetzias Mitzrayim. Which is why, if we pay attention to the Seder, the most important part of the Seder, for sure in the opinion of Chazal, is not Manishtana, is not Avadim Hayenu, it's not what was going on in Bnei Brak, and it wasn't Vihisha Amda, it wasn't any of the things that we tend to focus on. It was the Haggadah parts that are, where it says, skip the next 6 pages, and you kind of fly, or you just read quickly. All the parts of the drushos. What's a drasha? What does a drasha literally mean? To expound. What's happening is that Chazal are taking a look at a pasuk and saying, what's really going on here? What can I understand from this pasuk to apply more to this story, to apply more to my life? The focal point of Magid, the focal point of the Haggadah, actually, is to actually practice this, to do it ourselves, to look into the Haggadah, to look into the story, and see how it can relate, see what I can understand from this very, very small amount of information. The vast majority of the Yetzias Mitzrayim is not told over in the Haggadah. When does the story of the Yetzias Mitzrayim start in the Torah? This is a very easy question. We'll throw it to the corner. They're very smart. When does the Yetzias Mitzrayim story start?
Shmos.
When does it end? You're not going to get it wrong, Jim.
Shmos.
Okay, Chaim Brand has a good job of getting things wrong.
I listened to what he was
saying. When does the Yetzias Mitzrayim end? Maybe you'll say Bo, maybe Beshalach, maybe Yisro, maybe the end of Sefer Shmos. Maybe you'll say it's still happening now. Okay, fine. That's probably not accurate. But that's like 3, 4, 5, 6 parashios. Do we see all those parashios in the Haggadah? How come we don't just Leil Seder, how come Motzei Shabbos, we're not just next week, not this week, thank God, we're not just going to open up Chumash and start reading it? Because the point is not to remember the story, it's not to remember something that happened, it's to see how I can be freed, how I can be an Avadim Hayinu as well. Now, I'll just to spend a couple more minutes, I want to give you guys a vort, because we had three sort of large-scale mahalkim, large-scale like images and approaches to how to appreciate Leil HaSeder. I'll give you one idea you can walk away with, you could say over at your Seder. You might want to say the whole thing, but it's okay. What do we call matzah? Lechem Oni, right? What does lechem Oni mean? What does Oni mean?
Poor.
Poor man's bread. What makes matzah poor? Have you, you guys aren't involved in chopping that much, but do you know how much shmur matzah costs? It costs a ton of money. You know what's a lot cheaper than shmur matzah?
Bread.
Regular bread. Basically everything is cheaper than shmur matzah, but regular bread is for sure cheaper. We call it poor man's bread. Maharal explains because it's got nothing going for it. There's nothing there. It's someone who's rich, has a fancy car and a fancy watch and a fancy suit and a fancy house. Someone who's poor has none of those things. It's got none of the trappings. It's just the basic. The only similarity between the rich man and the poor man is their physical bodily makeup. The matzah, as lechem oni, is just flour and water. And zehu, nothing. No sugar, no honey, nothing exciting, nothing interesting. And so what makes it poor is the fact that it has nothing else. But we seem to speak positively about the fact that the matzah is lechem oni, that it's poor man's bread. So I want to tell you a story. This is a personal story that I had to get permission from my wife to tell. For those of you who don't know, I had a son almost 4 months ago. Say mazel tov. Little Chaim Zev, or little Zevi, was in the hospital for the first 2 weeks of his life. He was having seizures, and he stopped breathing when he would have those seizures. Baruch Hashem, he's doing well now, and God willing, he'll continue to do well. Now you say amen. But for the first 2 weeks, he was very scary. Chaim Zev was at the end of the room, and there were two other kids in the neonatal ICU, the NICU, as they call it. And so I would have to walk past these two other kids every day when I went to visit him. And as he was getting healthier, as he was getting closer and closer to leaving the hospital, they kept taking out all the different wires. There was a thing keeping track of his heart rate. There was a thing keeping track of his oxygen. There was a thing keeping him warm because he couldn't self-regulate his warmth. There was a thing making sure he could breathe at a certain point. There was a thing making sure there were tubes to feed him because if they started feeding him and he had a seizure, that would be a problem. So he had all these tubes and all these machines going on around him. And for the week leading up to when he left, they took away the tube to eat, and he was able to eat on his own. Then they took away the heating thing. He could regulate his own body heat. And they were taking away all these things, and every single time that they took apart something, they took something away, we had a little simcha. We had a little chayim. Not literally. We got excited because it meant that he was going to be more self-sufficient. It meant that he was going to be okay on his own. He was needing less in order to survive. And on the second to last day before we took Chaim Zev home, the only thing he had left was a heart rate monitor. That's just like standard operating procedure. You walk into the hospital, they'll throw a heart rate monitor on you. They don't care. But all of the things that he needed in order to survive were gone. He was living all by himself. He was living on his own. And I was so besimcha because he didn't need anything in order to live. And as I walked out of the room, on my left side was a very, very small baby. He was born, I think, at like 26 weeks, which is a lot earlier than 40 weeks, which is full term. And his name was Maverick. Maverick ultimately didn't make it, which is very sad. We feel bad for his parents, and God willing, they should have a nechama. But Maverick had a lot of machines. He had machines doing this thing and that thing all over. And I remember thinking something very powerful, and I thought it was my own Kiddush, but it's not. It's the Maharal that I had learned the previous year. When you need more to survive, that's bad. We don't want to need more. The ideal is that we should be as independent as possible, that I don't need anything else, that I don't need my phone in order to be happy. I don't need to have video games in order to be entertained. I don't even need my friends around in order for me to feel good about myself. I'm happy being me. I'm happy all by myself. Being comfortable, just being who you are, is the greatest gift you can ever have. And being able to literally live without needing machines, like Baruch Hashem all of us are able to do, is a tremendous bracha that I only appreciated once my son was in the hospital. Explains the Maharal, based as I understood it through Rav Aaron Lopiansky, the matzah doesn't need anything, and that's actually what makes it great. The fact that the matzah just exists on its own, that's called lechem oni, poor man's bread, but not poor man's bread in the fact that he can't afford something more, because quite practically, matzah costs a ton of money, but poor man's bread in that he's not needing anything else. What we celebrate on Lehel Seder is that we appreciate who we really are. We get down to the depths of what it means to be a Jew. I don't need anything else. I don't need even, we appreciated this last year more, I don't even need a community in order to survive. I can be connected, I can daven, I can learn by myself. I don't need to have someone encouraging me. I don't need to have someone waking me up for davening. I can be fully connected to a Kodesh Baruch Hu all by myself. That's the idea of Lechem Oni, just a tachazer. I would cause what everyone else said, but I'm going to mess it up, so I'm not going to. Joseph Campbell's idea of the monomyth is that every story we see, every mythological epic narrative we interact with is really a story about us, and that's what's happening in the Haggadah. The Haggadah is a story about us, that we're going to see ourselves, we're going to appreciate how the Haggadah is a story about me. That's what we do on Pesach. And the vort you can share is that lechem oni is not poor man's bread, means someone who doesn't need anything in order to survive, doesn't need anything in order to go on. It's good all on its own. It is now 8:45. That is the end of our program. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you so much to our rabbis for joining us. And you should all receive an email with a certificate with your name on it for your very own Donnie. If you signed up twice, then you lose your certificate. I'm so sorry, Micah. No, I'm kidding. But it's been a pleasure. Chag Kasher v'Sameach. Don't eat the Donnies on Pesach. That would be a big problem, okay? Shkayach.